Thank you for all coming out. You know, hot night. Escape the horrible Melbourne heat in this lovely venue. My name's Dan Flitton. I look after the Lowy Institute's digital magazine called The Interpreter, which is published daily, and we feature commentary on what's going on in the world, and it's what's going on in the world that's brought us all here this evening. And I had to think to myself, yeah, here we are. We're in January. Usually Australia has a holiday between Christmas and Monday just gone, but we've all learnt that it's very bad form to take holidays, particularly if you're a Prime Minister. That's been a feature, obviously just before Christmas. And then we go away for a couple of weeks there, and I think we're going to enjoy our times down the beach, and we see all of our friends that have been caught up in these terrible bushfires all through New South Wales and South Australia, and of course here in Victoria too. And whatever happened in Mallacoota was extraordinary, and the footage of it beamed all around the world, and a great global outpouring, which I must admit personally I found incredibly surprising, the scale of it, and koalas being tied to light poles in New York to memorialise what had happened in Australia. And of course, very sad news, and I know that we've some friends here this evening from the US consulate, sad news that three US firefighters who'd come from across the world to help Australia fighting the fires were killed when the plane crashed in south of Canberra a week or so back. All of this attention on what was happening in Australia, and then an extraordinary series of events in the Middle East after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and the Iranian general by the United States military in Iraq, all places that we've become very familiar with in the last 20 years, but nonetheless, again, to return to the headlines, the response from Iran. And then a virus from China. And that outbreak, which is not yet a pandemic, we're told, but an extraordinary number of people, I think more than 50 million now in quarantine, responses and reactions from all over the world, not least from Australia, and talk about quarantine and flying people home from Wuhan, put them on Christmas Island. But in the Pacific, small countries in the Pacific are requiring 3 days medical clearance before you can go to Samoa now, I saw today. And all of that news just in the last few weeks, and all of that did not get nearly as much airtime or print space as Harry and Meghan splitting from the royal family. I mean, that was a story. And if we're not sick of Mexit, you know, tomorrow we get Brexit. So we get all of this. All of this has been happening. This is one of my favourite events for the year, because we have regular events here for the Lowy Institute in Melbourne. We have regular events at the Lowy Institute's hosts in Sydney and around Australia as well. And usually we're a venue for bringing in international expertise to talk to Australians and help us educate around the world. But this is a great event for us, because this is really very much our Institute's expertise to look into crystal balls and to look at the year ahead and things to come. And of course, it always gets dominated partly by the news of the day, but this is a chance for us to look at some of the issues that are coming up in the year ahead. And we've got a terrific panel here who I'll introduce to you all in a minute. But one of the downsides of being an analyst, and I used to work for the Australian government in an intelligence job, and we used to talk about analytical tradecraft a lot. One of the downsides of being an analyst is that you do tend to always look at the bad news. So maybe even today I'll challenge the panel a little bit, challenge myself too, that maybe there's some good news that'll come out this year in amongst all of that bad news, but I don't have a great deal of confidence. We've got a US election coming up. We're in the middle of an impeachment saga. I don't know what's going to happen with that. I haven't seen the latest before I came in. Jonathan was telling me just as we were standing there earlier that Trump's been tweeting, so that's probably happened again in the last few minutes. Tokyo Olympics, and if you don't think that these can have big international ramifications, you only have to think back to 2 years ago with the Winter Olympics in Seoul, which really set in train this extraordinary series of diplomacy that we've seen with North Korea in the last 2 years, and we don't know quite where that's going to end. Saudi Arabia is going to host the G20. Journalists need not attend, but that's happening. Of course, then Hong Kong protests and the like. We may not cover all of these issues. We've got a panel here that's going to talk about areas that in their patch that they look at. But I'll introduce each in turn. Down at the far end of away from me, John Edwards is a senior fellow in the International Economy Program at the Lowy Institute, and John is a former board member of the Reserve Bank and was a former economic advisor to the then Prime Minister Paul Keating, and has in the meantime managed to write a series of excellent books and is a regular commenter on things to do with the world economy. Lydia Khalil is a research fellow in the West Asia program that we have at the Institute, and she's a specialist on the Middle East and on national security issues, terrorism related subjects in particular, and Lydia's worked both for the Boston and New York police departments, and like all of my colleagues, is regularly features as a commentator in the news. Jonathan Pryke runs the Pacific Island program at the Lowy Institute, which I think is fair to say has had a fair whack of attention in the last 18 months or so, and Jonathan will talk to us a bit about the step-up program that the Australian government has had, and there's been a lot of attention on the Pacific, and Jonathan's overseen putting together a terrific online product that we run called the Pacific Aid Map that shows all of the aid flow that goes to the Pacific region from across the world that you can access for free online, and it's wonderful. And he was previously at the Australian National University. And Bonnie Bly, who's next to me, is another research fellow, part of what we refer to as the Power Team. The Power Team is the another terrific online product that the Lowy Institute, a research project that the Lowy Institute's undertaken, which is extraordinary in its depth, called the Asia Power Index, which we've had events on here in Melbourne before. And it ranks countries from across the region on a series of measures. And Bonnie also looks after our global Global Diplomacy. I've written down Global Development Index and thought that was wrong. Global Diplomacy Index, and was previously with the International Institute of Strategic Studies. I've talked enough. I mentioned all of these issues that have been in the news in recent days, but there was one that I thought that we could start with, which perhaps hasn't had as much attention that it deserves, and it goes to John. And that's on this apparent phase one deal in the US-China trade war, and the implications of which would have been much more heavily discussed, I suspect, if it weren't for all of these other things that have been dominating the news most recently. You wrote for me a fascinating piece earlier this week about this unbelievable deal that Donald Trump described. Can you talk us through a little bit what that entails and how it might affect Australia?
Yeah, sure, Dan. Well, I think it's an extraordinary deal. Donald Trump called it an unbelievable deal, and he's right. It is, in a way, an unbelievable deal, but not in a good way. The main item is that China is committed to buy over this year and next an additional $200 billion in US exports. Well, how big is that? Well, if you just take the goods component, it turns out to be an 81% increase over what China bought from the goods that China bought from the US last year. 81% increase, or 87 billion US dollars increase this year. Well, just to give you a sense of the magnitude of that, that is more than the entire amount of goods that Australia sold to China in 2018, and we're a big supplier. It's a very big number. One of the implications for Australia is that the US is exporting to China, or would like to export to China a lot of things that we export. We don't export soybeans and they don't export iron ore, but apart from that, everything else, we compete with the US. Coal, liquid natural gas, petroleum gas, dairy, wine, beef, lamb, everything that the US wants to sell a lot more of, we sell to China, and I think we're going to find a little bit of tension there as this year goes on. I'm not entirely convinced that $87 billion is possible. It's already, you know, it's just about February. And if China was really going to increase its purchases from the US by 81% over the course of this year, I would expect to be now reading about that in the South China Morning Post or the Wall Street Journal, about extravagant contracts that were being signed or big plans that were being laid, and I haven't read anything. Well, of course, China's got a lot else on its mind right now, but that might continue right through March, April, coronavirus. And it may be that we're well into the year before China has to face up to this issue of whether it actually can do it. So that's one aspect. It's not good for Australia. It competes with our exports. Another aspect of it, though, is good for Australia, and that's this. There was a suggestion at the beginning of this whole episode, 2 years ago, that what the US is really wanting to do was decouple from China. Well, if it ever did, it's been very, very unsuccessful, and this agreement goes in the opposite direction. That is, the US is now demanding that China buy more of its stuff, that trade with China goes up. It hasn't placed any further restrictions on China's exports to the US. No, so far as I know, no major US corporation over the last 2 years has declared it doesn't want to participate in the China economy. And China affiliates of US corporations are now, at least 2 years ago, were selling nearly $400 billion of materials produced in China, mostly to the China market. So it's huge for the US business. That hasn't been touched. And not only that, in the first 6 months of last year, foreign investment in China increased quite considerably compared to the last 6 months of 2018. So that again suggests to me that if decoupling was ever intended, it hasn't worked, and that's good for Australia.
And you mentioned there, John, the $87 billion ambition, all of which could be quickly undone by this viral outbreak if it spreads further. I mean, all this very speculative, but if it spreads further and it has a big cost to the economy. Bonnie, if I draw you in, though, on the Wuhan coronavirus, in from the research that you've done, how do you think that this is going to test China and its international reputation in the coming months?
Yeah, sure. I do think it goes beyond just the news of the day, the coronavirus. We're starting to see a number of articles come out talking about the economic implications as well. So when China struggles economically, everyone will struggle economically. And of course, this has huge economic repercussions. But I want to talk about the Chinese response specifically to the crisis, because when these large-scale virus crises happen, you expect two things. The first is extreme transparency, and the second is draconian measures. So on one measure, we know that China is pretty strong, and that's sort of following through best practices in terms of quarantining, in terms of, you know, the travel ban, which is quite an impressive feat on that side of the equation. As far as we can see, it's still early days. On the transparency side, there's a lot less clarity about how fast China has been in terms of reporting, you know, where it started, how it started, how it's spreading, and so on. There's a lot of unanswered questions, and more information coming to light every single day. Now, this ties back into a much bigger question that I look at in my work, which is, you know, where does China sit in terms of its ambition and its influence and its, you know, its reputation globally? Because we know that China has great power, and to use the old cliche, with great power comes great responsibility.
The Spider-Man rule.
Yes, well, and so part of my research is to ask, you know, will we see China actually act responsibly in this particular crisis? And I think it is more important than just, you know, the sort of next few months as the virus spreads and so on. I think we're actually facing a much bigger question as to whether China can be, you know, asked to fulfill its international obligations, you know, as a huge contributor to our economy, to everything. Can it actually fulfill these obligations? Now, it is very early days. I've got no idea in which direction this is going to move. But I think it's very important to watch how China responds, not only to the coronavirus, but also, you know, to the ongoing Hong Kong issues. We still have, you know, the millions of Uyghurs in detention in Xinjiang. Of course, Taiwan recently had an election that, you know, did not look very favorable for Beijing. There's a number of tests that China's being put through at the moment. And the question is, how will China respond to these? And I think that will really shape its international reputation in the next 12 months as well.
Yeah. The virus, we could be careful here, because what we know about the virus is that I think the latest figures were that, tragically, about 170 people have died as a consequence, and there were about 8,000 cases. But it's not, as I understand it, been called a pandemic yet by the World Health Organization, so that the prospects of this spreading is still a prospect. It's scary, but it's still a prospect. But there are transnational issues, Jonathan, transnational issues across international borders, which are very real and very difficult for governments to cope with. And we've been debating climate change as one of them in this country for a long time. When you're looking out at the Pacific, climate change is one of the key issues which seems to be discussed quite prominently. In your view, where is it that the Morrison government needs to move in the coming year in order to step up, to use its language, to step up on its ambition?
Well, yeah, climate change is certainly the Achilles heel of the renewed engagement that we're seeing from the Morrison government in the Pacific. But, I mean, before we get to that, I do actually have some good news for you.
Good.
It's really quite personal in that career prospects as a Pacific analyst are looking really good in 2020, much better than they were 2 years ago. So, you know, if I was sitting on the stage 2 years ago, there was no way I would have predicted that the penny was going to drop of this renewed focus and the Pacific really vaulting from the fringe to the centre of foreign policy thinking in the Morrison government. It's been really quite phenomenal. And they have committed to a huge step-up effort in the region. There's more money, there's more both aid in terms of the volume and in terms of proportion of the total aid program. There's more diplomatic missions, there's more security partnerships. There's a new lending facility to go head-to-head with China and infrastructure investments in the region. There's all this stuff happening. And, you know, there's limited political and bureaucratic bandwidth to deal with, and I think both are quite stretched at the moment. So the big challenge for the Morrison government this year is going to be one of consistency, of delivering all these new commitments and keeping up this level of intensity. Because whilst Australia and the politicians and bureaucrats might have the institutional memory of 3 years, the Pacific have very long memories and they've seen all this before. And then they see a new crisis emerge, a new issue somewhere else, and they see Australia just disappear or start flying over them again. So that's the big challenge for them. I think it's climate change is a big one, particularly in the regional fora. We saw it play out in Tuvalu in the Pacific Island Forum last year. We'll see it play out again this year in Vanuatu. And what needs to change for them? Well, I don't think our relationship with the Pacific is going to change this government's position on climate change. I think the fires have a much better prospect of doing that. But it certainly doesn't help. The language needs to change first, and then the action, because they can see through the language. But when you go into every negotiation, not only in the region, but also globally, and are seen as being the belligerent in these negotiations, that really does not play well for a government that is using the rhetoric in the region as we're part of the family. You know, when your family feel like they're going to go underwater this century, it doesn't really ring true to them. So, I am a supporter of... I'm glad this government's re-engaged in the region. It is well overdue, but they've got their work cut out for them to keep to build a genuine sense of partnership and family with the region.
Can you explain for us a little bit about the efforts that the Pacific has made itself in the last couple of last few weeks after the bushfires to offer support?
Sure.
Because it seems quite extraordinary.
Yeah, look, you mentioned earlier that how heartwarming it's been seeing this outpouring of support from around the world for Australia, and that's been no more true than in the Pacific. It's typically a one-way relationship when it comes to giving. You know, the Pacific have severe and acute development challenges that Australia is spending a lot to help them with. And, you know, there is a lot of argy-bargy when it comes to talking about climate change and certain policies, but when, you know, the rubber hits the road, when they're in crisis or we're in crisis, we come to each other's aid. And the Pacific has really, stepped up, to use this government's language. Mm. The PNG Defence Force has sent 100 engineers to help build bridges and clear debris in the worst affected regions in southern New South Wales. The Fiji Defence Force has sent similar numbers. There's also been community organisations, church groups, all sorts of donations coming from around the Pacific. You know, whereas it's not a huge amount of money, but to them it is a lot. And yeah. You know, these people have severe challenges themselves, but they're willing to give back to Australia. And it's really been quite emotive for me personally watching all this play out in the Pacific media.
And not to turn the glass darkly, but the downside is that if you don't take advantage of those opportunities where there's goodwill, you can end up in a crisis again. And here in Victoria, if you remember back in 2009 after the Black Saturday event, there was an extraordinary generous donation made by Indonesia. And if you go down to the Indonesian consulate, which is just down the road here, you can see that some of the charred wood that was taken from the fire zones then, and the Indonesians donated several million dollars towards the recovery effort, and there was a great deal of goodwill that followed at the time. But then the next crisis came, and the revelations about Australian espionage, and then the execution of the Bali Nine. Those sorts of events derail the relationship again, although Jokowi comes back and is going to speak in the Australian Parliament next week or the week after, thereabouts. So, yeah, there's an opportunity there. Take advantage of it. That's the challenge. I'm going to segue, bit of a head snap, to go right the way across to the other side of the world, but I want to draw Lydia in. And I was fascinated. Some of you may have seen there was an article which was republished in one of the local newspapers here. It was actually from the Wall Street Journal, a debate in the United States about US interests in the Middle East. And it was written by Martin Indyk, who's a former US ambassador to Israel and other places, I think. He was also formerly on the Lowy Institute's board, and he was formerly an Australian, actually, funnily enough. But he wrote an article saying that there are no US interests in the Middle East, and they should wake it up to this fact and look at withdrawing, or words to that effect. I thought this was fascinating, but actions seem to suggest otherwise. And I mentioned the assassination, Lydia. There's tensions with Iran, there's the Iraq troops debate on now, but also a series of rolling protests across the Middle East. I mean, frame it for us however you like, but there's something that keeps the United States engaged in the region, but not just the United States. It's also draws back Australia. Australia's just in the last month sent another warship to the Gulf.
Yeah, I think that question of why is the United States still engaged in the Middle East, or what exactly are the United States' interests in the Middle East, I think it's a great question. I wouldn't agree totally with Martin Indyk saying that there are no U.S. interests in the region, but I think it's a serious question that not only has he been grappling with, but I'd argue the U.S. government's and the U.S. public have been grappling with probably since the end of the Bush administration and the start of the global financial crisis. I think that was a marker where many in the United States said, what are we getting out of our engagement in the region? We are coming, you know, off the back of the global war on terror. At that point, you know, we had been engaged for 10 years. Now we are engaged almost 20 years with the global war on terror, largely fought in the Middle East. the deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan have been the longest deployments that U.S. troops have had, and frankly, with very little to show for it, at least in terms, if you talk about it in terms of opportunity cost and the blood and treasure that was spent and the benefits that have accrued to the United States and its allies. So it is a great question. You know, Indyk's piece grappled with it. President Trump has also been a very vocal advocate of, and the insistence that the United States not only withdraw its military involvement from the region and more globally, but also not engage further. And he's probably the most vocal advocate, but it's not an uncontroversial position in the United States. If you look at the other Democratic candidates as well, like Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, they have very similar positions, even though the details are, you know, slightly different to Trump. So what is it that keeps the U.S. interested and engaged and the world and its allies? Well, I think there are a lot of reasons for the U.S. to remain invested in the region, because there's a great deal of instability in the region that affects us all globally, whether it's in the form of a global terrorism that continues, extremism, refugee flows, the risk of nuclear proliferation, all of that affects the global security environment, and it emanates within the Middle East. You mentioned the protests that are ongoing in the region. Now, again, these are not new, you know.
What we've seen Lebanon, Syria, Iraq itself.
Yes, they've been ongoing, little bits in Egypt, despite the repressive environment. So they've been continuing. It was kind of culminated in the Arab uprisings, but they've continued. And we don't see any signs of these protests abating. And I'd say that fundamentally, I mean, there's a lot of reasons for this. It's a very complex mix of economic and political and cultural amalgam of different things that are going wrong in the region that are driving them. But at its core, it's really a conflict between the state and the citizen. That's a crisis of citizenship within the region that's not going away anytime soon. Now, I think what we have to ask ourselves as outsiders to the region is what role can the United States or allies or others around the world to impact that? Because fundamentally, it's an internal matter within the populations and their governments. I think at the very least, we need to reconsider how our foreign policy favors these strongmen and autocrats that are ruling much of the region. You see President Trump bragging about his relationship with Sisi and MBS in Saudi Arabia. He calls Sisi his favorite dictator. And again, it's not just President Trump. This has been longstanding U.S. foreign policy to favor strongman actors, with the notable exception of the Bush administration's freedom agenda, which went off the rails. That's a different discussion. But I think we need to ultimately reconsider that, because at its core, these relationships that further authoritarianism and repression in the region are themselves extremely unstable and continue to drive that instability and won't help answer the question and that crisis point of state and citizen relationship within the region. So at the very least, we should start examining that hopefully in the new decade.
Yeah. We've got... I'm going to do another run around the panel with some more questions, but we've got an informed and interested audience here, so we'd like to hear from you. So if you've got some questions that you want to think up momentarily, I'll get some roaming mics to head around in about 10 minutes or so. But Lydia, we talked there about the instability in the Middle East and the effect that it can have on the rest of the world. And I was just going to draw John in again too on this question. The cynics were quick to say, I'm not going to say that I was one of them, but maybe I was, the wag the dog syndrome might have been at play somewhat with Donald Trump and the assassination, the timing of the assassination in January, right as the impeachment issues coming on. It did send a spike in oil prices for a moment, but perhaps because Iran hasn't actually been contributing much to the global oil flows, it didn't seem to hold very long. But it causes an economic disruption. We've got an election coming up, John, in the United States. In the coming months, we'll see more and more debate between whoever emerges as the Democratic candidate and Donald Trump himself. What's your sense of this? How this could affect the global economy in the year ahead? Is that something that markets, business, governments have already taken into account, that these things have happened? What do you see as sort of the risks for the global economy out of this?
Well, I think there are risks there, and I'll come to those in a second. But the differences that are posed by the US election campaign, I don't think are as significant as other things that are going on in the world economy, and we can reflect on 2019 to figure out what those were. That is, we saw through 2019 a really dramatic loosening of monetary policy in the US and a reversal of tightening in the UK, in Europe, and of course here and in other places. That is, monetary policy starting out in 2020, much easier than it was in early 2019, and that has a sort of delayed effect. That's one impact on 2020, which is probably bigger anyway than the US election campaign, but that's not the only one. There was a manufacturing downturn in the global economy last year, which brought with it a downturn in global trade. That was sort of partly accidental. It was partly emission standards in Germany for auto production. It was partly a kind of cyclical technology production event in East Asia. And it was partly some credit constraints that were applying in China in the first half of last year, which have subsequently been eased. Well, and the final one, of course, was the trade war between the US and China, together accounting for 40% of global GDP. Well, all those things seem to be less important. That is, on the most recent indications, the manufacturing downturn is alleviating. The trade war, I think, will be back into it in 2 years, but not for the next 18 months. And meanwhile, we have the effect of those early monetary policy easings coming. So I think the outlook for the global economy is a little bit better in 2020 than
good news
2019. On the US election, well, I guess the predominant bet now is that Trump gets re-elected, although I personally think Biden, if he gets up as candidate, will, you know, Trump has a very passionate constituency, but not a huge constituency, whereas Biden might have the ability to pull together, you know, a Democratic majority plus and might be a serious candidate. I don't see the difference between their kind of economic attitudes as sufficiently important to factor into an account of the way in which the global economy will perform in 2020.
Which might be more good news, really. Lydia, does Donald Trump win?
Could be. I've said since he got elected the first time that it will see either two terms or he'll be impeached. And the way that the impeachment trial's going right now, it's not looking... Well, it's looking good for him that he won't be impeached. So I think there is a very real possibility that he could be reelected. What that means for the future of the United States, its global leadership, its relationship with its allies, I don't see how... the U.S. system and democracy is quite resilient, but I think surviving two terms of Trump is going to be a much more difficult proposition to kind of bounce back to where it was than just one term. I think when we take a look at this broader election, though, in the United States, the reason why I'm more bullish on Trump is that it's much harder for any of the Democratic candidates to, one, get turnout, and also they need to appeal to the center. The Democrats need to appeal to the center in a way that Republicans don't, because the Republican Party has essentially become the party of Trump, and he will drive out Republican voters, whereas the Democratic and the mainstream of America is much more divided between those that would favor Biden or those that would favor a much more different type of progressive Democratic candidate like Warren or Sanders. So it's looking dicey, I think, for the Democrats. I mean, politics is notoriously unpredictable, so we'll see. But that's always been my feeling ever since he got elected.
Yeah, if we'd have sat here and 2016, I don't think that any of us would have sat here and said Brexit will happen, Donald Trump will get elected in January of that year. But
yeah,
there we are, it's only 4 years ago. Yeah. Bonnie, on the US election, What is it that you're paying attention to in terms of the potential further damage that, Donald Trump could cause?
Sure. So I look at things from the angle of diplomatic influence, and I think there's a lot to be said for what's currently happening in the US. So last year in November, I released some research called the Global Diplomacy Index, not development, which you mentioned earlier. And the finding there was quite remarkable, that China now has a larger diplomatic network than the US does. It's only by 3 posts, but it's pretty incredible that China has sort of overtaken the US on this particular metric. So China added 5 new diplomatic posts since 2017. The US, meanwhile, has sort of entered a period of diplomatic limbo. So it's added no new posts to its overall network, and it's closed its consulate general in St. Petersburg after deteriorating relations with Russia. So for me, the interesting question is, you know, where is the State Department going to go from here? We've seen it come very much under a lot of pressure from the Trump administration. So I think at least only 73% of key positions have been filled now, even though we're approaching sort of last final bit of Trump's first term. Maybe there'll be a second, we'll see. You know, we've seen repeated attempts by the Trump administration to put pressure on the State Department's budget and on USAID's budget. The question is, you know, how much longer can this go on for? Now, the impeachment brings another particular problem to the table, which is senior foreign service officials have been playing a key part in providing the testimony in the case against Donald Trump. And I think that means that the bridge between the State Department and the executive branch, which is already, you know, a very spindly rope bridge, is pretty much burnt at this point. I have to be boring and agree with Lydia that I think, yes, we could manage 4 years under Trump, but I think US diplomacy in 8 years with, you know, the possibility of another 4 years of Trump looks quite a bit more pessimistic, actually. The sort of little ray of hope for US diplomacy, because I do think it is well established. It takes years to build, years to maintain, and also a lot of effort to deconstruct. I do think the ray of hope is that if you look at where countries are choosing to locate their diplomatic posts overseas, the US remains a much more important destination. So it is by far and away attracts far more diplomatic staff, diplomatic networks than China does. So it will take a lot for, you know, for that to change.
There may also be an element of that's Washington in particular, with the headquarters for the World Bank, is a big draw cards, and some of that's not going to shift just with whoever's sitting in the White House.
Absolutely,
it's not just we're critical. I used to be critical. I used to work in the Australian media and used to be critical that we spent too much time talking about the United States and US elections. So let's move away from that to something a bit closer to home. I know it's going to sound like a big shift, but it's very important for Australia. We had another election just to our north late last year. It was a referendum on whether or not a country would become independent. Whether or not a place would become an independent country in Bougainville. And it was an extraordinary result, 98%. Is that right?
97.7.
97%. Now, if you'd had heard this result in North Korea, we'd have dismissed it. But tell us, Jonathan, about the significance of it.
I think it's about the same as the president of Turkmenistan gets in elections there. So pretty overwhelming, considering he runs unopposed. It has been the culmination of a really phenomenal peace process in the island province of Bougainville in Papua New Guinea, just our nearest neighbour to the north. Through the 1990s, there was a huge amount of Bougainville descended into crisis, a combination of many factors, largely centred around a major mine that was operated in Bougainville, that frustration that most of the proceeds of this mine were going to the central government or to Rio Tinto, who then operated the mine. And conflict led to 10 years of conflict that resulted in 20,000 indirect deaths thanks to the decline of services on the province of Bougainville. The 1999 Bougainville Peace Agreement brought that to an end, and has been running for the last 20 years. The agreement dictated that by the end of the 20 years period, Bougainville would have the right to a referendum for independence. That carrot was played out at the end of last year. By all accounts, the referendum itself was run freely and fairly and quite effectively, particularly in the context of PNG, where elections can be quite dodgy. And, you know, the results speak for itself, even if there were some ballot boxes gone awry, that, you know, what's the point in contesting such an overwhelming result? And there was a real sense of catharsis on the ground through this process, that this is really a really momentous moment for the people of Bougainville, and a cathartic one, really closing a chapter but starting a new one. But it does put many parties into a bind, particularly Papua New Guinea. This is not the end of the process. The agreement stipulates that this is a non-binding referendum, that we now enter a period of negotiation with the PNG government, and the final decision on Bougainville's independence will be made by the Parliament of Papua New Guinea. And there's a lot of
different... Without a time frame too, isn't there? There's no guillotine for this.
That's right. There is no stipulation as to how long the period of consultation between the two governments will last. It's all further complicated by the Bougainville government, or the provincial government, having an election in the middle of the year, so the PNG government doesn't know who they're going to be negotiating with. They're trying to implement a constitutional reform to keep the current president in, who was coincidentally one of the founding fathers of Papua New Guinea as a whole. But then there's also this boiling tension throughout the rest of Papua New Guinea that this could be the start of a further unravelling of PNG. PNG is a very ethnically and culturally diverse country, over 800 individual spoken languages. It's a very dysfunctional country. Many other island provinces feel like they could do better going it alone. And indeed, many other provinces throughout the country think the same. And so there's a lot of concern that, you know, this could be the start of an unravelling. And so there's a lot of push by people within Papua New Guinea to keep Bougainville part of PNG at any cost. So this is going to be very sensitive to watch play out, and, you know, Australia is going to be front row and the sidelines as it all plays out, but there's not going to be any conclusion anytime soon. And it's not the only referendum happening in the Pacific. This year we've got two more. We've got one planned for Chuuk in Federated States of Micronesia, a very strategically sensitive part of the world when you look at it geographically, right in the middle between China and the United States, and close to Guam and Hawaii. We have the second referendum in New Caledonia as part of their peace agreement. And the first one 2 years ago was much closer than anyone predicted to separate from France. So yeah, a lot of referendums and other elections going on in the region to keep us occupied.
And of course, across the ditch, Jacinda.
Absolutely.
Jacinda faces an election, not a referendum, but perhaps a referendum on her.
Yeah, the darling of the international community. It seems like it's about much closer domestically that the Nationals feel like they're in for a real good chance.
We've got some time for questions, and Kate and Jen have got some microphones to bring around. I've just got a projector light in my eye, so you'll just have to forgive me if I'm squinting and trying to figure out. But Jen, just right here in the middle.
Thank you for your insights. Bonnie, you mentioned that if you look at diplomatic networks, China is somewhat expanding and the US is contracting somewhat. And when you look at the Belt and Road Initiative from China and the Pacific as a proxy site for, I guess, wars between Taiwan and China, I'm wondering, how will America respond to this sort of on-the-ground investment in infrastructure strategically, and also buying the hearts and minds of people in those regions?
There's a lot packed into that question. And on the Pacific part, perhaps Jono can also give you some answers. But what we did find was that looking at China's diplomatic network, it had more consulates, more consulates than the US does. So it tends to favour the model of consulates over embassies. And the idea, you know, that I think comes out of that is that potentially China is looking to marry its sort of diplomatic initiatives with its BRI initiatives, its economic ambitions. On Taiwan, it's fascinating because I think the reason why China has now been able to overtake the US in terms of its diplomatic network is because it has slowly picked away Taiwan's partners. So we can see how all these issues become very closely conflated, including, obviously, most recently, two countries in the Pacific. All these issues become very closely conflated, and I think are very strategic on China's part as well.
Your sense of the BRI in the Pacific, or Chinese aid in the Pacific? I know it's a big question, but...
Chinese aid, I mean, the presence of China in the Pacific is very real. 20 years ago, people would tell you that on average, the face you would see, you'd most typically see a Western face in the Pacific 20 years ago, the foreign face, and these days it's most absolutely someone who's ethnic Chinese, be it Chinese mainland, Chinese Malaysian, Taiwan, you name it. And so the presence is very real, and it's happened quite quickly in this 20-year span, so there is a lot of anxiety. And on the aid front, they have emerged as a significant aid player. They're the third largest. They contribute about 8% of total aid. That's very far away from Australia. We give 50% of all aid to the Pacific, so they've still got a lot of catching up to do. But best numbers will show that the commercial activity that Chinese businesses are engaged in dwarfs their aid. You know, it's at minimum 10 times, and I would argue it's even much larger. Right. So the aid investment was a vehicle to get Chinese business into the region, because the way they do aid is they do big loans for infrastructure projects that are implemented by Chinese state-owned enterprise. So they're a vehicle to get these Chinese businesses in, and they've now put down deep roots and are operating across the board, retail, industry, small-scale businesses. You know, they are all over the place. But how much of this is being, you know, puppet-mastered by the CCP in Beijing, I'm not so sure. I think it's much more messy than that. There's a lot of economic opportunity in the Pacific that you can get away with out of the prying eyes of Beijing and their anti-corruption programs. But it is definitely changing the fabric of the Pacific in ways that I know Canberra and others are very anxious about, and I share that anxiety, quite frankly.
Yeah, no one does capitalism better than the communists. I'll let anyone else jump in if they want to, but... Failing that, there was a gentleman, just Jen, just behind. Thanks.
Carrying on with the aid in the Pacific, I was in the Cook Islands a few years ago, and Australia had given them a warship that we didn't want, valued at a huge amount of aid dollars. There was no money in the country to train the sailors. They had no money for fuel. Is the aid administered better than that now, or is it all the nice headline?
I'll contest you on a number of points on that one. So we do have a Pacific Patrol Boat program where we give a patrol vessel to every Pacific Island country that is actually manned by an Australian naval personnel, a mechanic, to actually keep the thing maintained. They do have authority over where they send the ship and what it does, and you know they have to keep it fueled. So if they don't have the money for the fuel, it stays in the port. But you know it is maintained, and it is not an aid expenditure. It comes out of the defence budget. It is used for policing their own exclusive economic zones. You know, we think of the Pacific as small island nations, but they consider themselves large ocean nations. Their exclusive economic zones collectively make up 15% of the world's surface. These are essential services that we're helping provide for them. And we're actually just rolling out a whole new program and a new set of beefed up patrol boats going to every Pacific nation. And they're extremely valued by these nations. So if Cook's wasn't providing the fuel, well, you know, that's something that the government should be wrestling with. But most of these boats are used to great effect to help better police fisheries, increase government revenue, which then can help the budget in these countries then pay for the fuel.
It's a fascinating thing. If you've never really looked into it after this evening, I'll give you some reading, some homework to do. Go away, do it. And look at the compact associations that some of these island nations have with larger metropole countries. So in Cook Islands' case, it's with New Zealand, but there's others with the United States. And there's been occasional talk. We ran a piece about it a while ago at Lowy Institute about whether or not this might be an arrangement that Australia should look at for compact agreements with the Pacific Islands, whether they would cede some of their sovereignty on these sorts of questions to do with policing their sovereign waters, tuna fisheries and the like, which can be preyed upon and are very hard to police in exchange for support in that way. But of course, it's up to them. It's a question of sovereignty, and it's a pretty hot debate. I think there were some hands just down the front here. Thanks, Kate.
Yeah, hi, thank you. My name is Brian Kraft with Cardno International Development. Perhaps more interesting than upcoming elections is past elections, because you can sort of stop reading the tea leaves and make some more real analysis about what these recently appointed people are going to do. India, Indonesia, and Thailand just went through elections in 2019. So I'd be really interested to hear your guys' thoughts about South and Southeast Asia and where that factors in, and particularly with the pivot away from mainland or Southeast Asia from Australia as well as the United States post-Obama. And kind of what the shift towards the Pacific means for that region. Thank you.
We're a bit short on the panel for those three countries, I'm conscious, but I mean, other than I was once in a Bollywood film, but I'll leave that aside for India. In all seriousness, the issues to do with the Modi government's decision on the Citizenship Amendment Bill in India have been extraordinary and have
have caught widespread attention, but perhaps not as much attention as they should have. And Kashmir remains in an effective lockdown. So the oversight on our part, we should have mentioned that a little earlier. But the relations with Indonesia, Jokowi, I mentioned, is coming to Australia. Thailand also, Southeast Asia broadly. You guys...
I might just speaking on behalf of my Southeast Asian colleagues. You know, we are dealing with a government that has a fixed pie of, you know, finance and money to throw around, and so a Pacific step up, particularly on the aid front, does come at a step down elsewhere. You know, we have seen this coalition government, you know, taking its entirety from Tony Abbott through to today, has decimated the aid program, has, you know, slashed aid to Southeast Asia, to almost completely eradicated it from South Asia and the Middle East. So, you know, the step up in the Pacific does come at a cost. It comes at on the aid front, on the diplomatic front, on the political bandwidth. And, you know, as a Pacific analyst, I just say I don't care. You know, like, the Pacific needs this attention. It's long overdue. But it is just, we do have, I would argue, we do have large interests in that part of the world that we should be much more engaged in. But, I mean, this is just the hard calculus that this government is making. But I know that there is a lot of frustration within the bureaucracy, with my colleagues, about the attention that the Pacific region gets, perhaps at the cost of others.
I'd say, too, with some of the work that I've been taking a look at with extremism, I've been paying attention to what's happening in India and in Indonesia, and those elections have been consequential in terms of the focus on anti-Muslim sentiment that's been growing in Asia. Particularly India is a prime example of that with the citizenship bill. And so one of the concerns about that is, if we're taking a look at the growth of extremism or jihadism, in particular within the Asia region and globally, what's happening in India not only threatens its reputation as a stalwart of democracy in the global south, but has the potential to foment more extremism through this kind of push of mainstreaming anti-Muslim sentiment within the country and potentially in the region. Indonesia, of course, is a majority Muslim country, but Jokowi's election did focus on extremism rather than just violence. That was a very big factor within the Indonesian elections. And he copped the criticism of using that as a way to kind of clamp down on legitimate dissent as well. So all of these issues are very problematic when we talk about looking at the growth of extremism, of violence, of anti-Muslim sentiment, and the authoritarian pushes globally and the suppression of dissent in the name of countering extremism, which is something that we have to be very careful about.
Yeah, and on Indonesia, there's been, others will speak to it with a lot more authority than I can, but there's great concern about democratic retrenchment and them winding back six achievements that they've had over the last 20 years, and that things have been wound back under Jokowi because of nationalist tendencies, and we've seen him increasingly pushing on issues to do with South China Sea too, which of course excite people.
Hi, Alex Wake from RMIT. I teach journalism, and I hope that this isn't a too self-interested question, but I'm listening to this fascinating panel, and I'm wondering, how can we make Australians interested, to make Australian politicians interested with the state of the media? Many of the issues that you've spoken about today just aren't making it into the papers, and I wonder if anyone's got any positive, good ideas out there that I can go forth and spread to my young charges.
Well, the audience should know, Alex has written for me. So one of the things that you can keep doing, Alex, is keep writing for me. That's terrific, because your contribution is great. I just jump in quickly, because I've been fascinated with these debates for a long time, and went through the decline of Fairfax and then left, and now I see that it's with Channel 9. And if you speak to former colleagues, they now think things are better in that there has been debates that we've had about the decline of the media. And that the media has started to adjust, and we've all started to adjust in the way in which we get our information. But what I think is really fascinating in this moment is the way in which some of our information can get distorted, and it's those deliberate distortion efforts. And we've talked a bit about election campaigns. In the US election in 2016, looking back, the Russians interfered. Maybe it was the Ukraine, if you'd listened to Donald, but it was that prospect for interference in the UK, Cambridge Analytica, the way in which Facebook has been gamed, those sorts of issues, the debates about the way in which we get our information. I disagree a little, Alex, in that I think that these debates are there, and I think that the audience has always been disinterested to an extent. We've always had arguments about trying to get more people to pay attention to what's going on in the world and to pay attention to the way in which they get their information. I think that the vehicle for it has shifted. And if I can just switch to the bushfires, I think one of the reasons that's underexplored as to the reason why the bushfires got so much global attention this time is when we had our last big bushfire episode in 2009, not everybody had a smartphone then. So we didn't see images of firefighters driving through the forests with the trees on fire right next to their trucks. That still happened, but we didn't get to go along for the ride, so to speak. And I think, or at least not to the same quantity of it and the ease of access through social media and sharing on Facebook, Twitter and all that sort of thing. So I think that these debates are happening, but I think that they're just happening in such disparate ways that it can become a bit distressing as to how effective they are.
Thank you. My question is to Mr. Edwards, I think. It goes to the US trade deal with China, where they have pressured China into concessions that could well be damaging to Australia, as China is our biggest trading partner. And yet Australia seems to have been very subservient in not saying anything about it. I mean, the United States wouldn't hesitate to criticise any country that took action that the United States saw against its economic and trade interests. Yet we seem to be totally subservient to them on this matter. Don't you think we should speak up more on these sort of issues?
Well, I agree. I mean, the US was chastising us not so long ago, and chastising Korea, Japan, Germany for its for having too much trade with China. For what was said to be our economic dependence on China. But the consequence of this agreement, basically, is that the US has elbowed us out of the way in the race to get into the China market. And the Minister for Trade didn't have much to say about it. He thought that the consequences for Australia in terms of competition with our trade would be dealt with just by the growth of the market. Well, I don't think that's going to be so, because we've only got this 1 year. It's very front-loaded, this deal. He did say, and I agree with him, that, you know, it's good to have an agreement. And he didn't say, but I assume it's also a thought of his, that decoupling is evidently not proceeding, and that's in our interests. I understand that we do... we do make these representations. I know that the Australian, you know, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade is very conscious of the trade diversion aspect of this agreement. So I assume we're making these points privately, but I don't think it'd do us any harm if we made it publicly also.
Hey, it's Travis here. I heard being discussed before about Belt and Road Initiative and Xinjiang. And what I was curious about was recently, I believe, NATO just put China as number one enemy or something like along those lines with China. And with Xinjiang, there's a lot of the information's been coming out through historically propaganda, I mean Cold War propaganda things, like Radio Free Asia, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, Voice of America, and a lot of the research has been done by Adrian Zenz, who is part of, what's the name of the institute? It's another American-funded research institute, and a lot of the witnesses have been coming out through these media outlets, and family members have been coming out saying that it's not true and whatnot. And I was just curious, with the Muslim world coming out, I believe, over 50 endorsing what China is doing. Do you think that there's possibly some weaponizing against Xinjiang at the moment, or do you believe that there's genuinely human rights abominations happening in Xinjiang?
I mean, the idea that governments would lie, I'd be shocked. But, shocked. But, I mean, I don't... I've seen these sorts of debates. Just speaking for myself, you always question your sources. You always question... Any analyst will read carefully and read widely and wonder as to what's going on. But I'd say that there's more than ample evidence of things going badly in Xinjiang. And not just from the kind of sources that you've described, although I'm sure that those sorts of things, that there's been information that's come from those as well. Does anyone else want to jump in on?
Well, I'd just maybe add something to the point that you made about how a lot of the Organization of Islamic States and Muslim majority countries have you know, either not come out against China or have endorsed. And I'd point to kind of the earlier point I made in the discussion about the disconnect between a lot of Arab governments and their citizens. I was recently in the region in December, actually attending a conference about the relations between the Middle East and China. And that came up very frequently. And what you've noticed is that there is a serious disconnect between what the average person within the Middle East thinks about what's going on with China and the province and their outrage over that versus what their governments and their leaders are saying. And it's been very disconcerting for the average citizen, the fact that their governments, who, particularly Saudi Arabia, who presents itself as the leader of the Islamic world, not coming out more strongly against actions that threaten other Muslims around the world. So you definitely see that as one. I also talked a bit earlier about how this issue of anti-Muslim sentiment around the world, and particularly in Asia, and certainly what's happening in China with the Uyghur population features very strongly in that. You see a lot of extremist actors and jihadist actors starting to take what is going on there and use it for their own ends and for their own messaging and for their own propaganda. I'll caveat that by saying that even still, the Arab world still does not pay attention to what's happening in Asia as much as it should have. But I think with what's going on with China and the Uyghur population, we're starting to see a shift in that.
One of the rules that we have, and I'm sorry to disappoint everybody who had their hands up, but one of the rules that we have at the Lowy Institute is that we have to finish on time. I think Jen's putting up a hand to tell me that I have to finish on time. So it's now just after 7:15. We've actually run a couple of minutes over. So I'm going to let you all go out back into the heat and enjoy. I am sure that somewhere amongst those hands that were up, there was a question about Megan and Harry. I'd be really disappointed if this was an entirely Republican audience. But I really do want to thank you all for coming out this evening. It's, as I said, it's a terrific event. I've really enjoyed it. It's great to have colleagues down from Sydney. It's terrific to have you all travel here, and I hope that this helps to enlighten what's going to be happening throughout the coming months in the... And undoubtedly, as Harold Macmillan said, there'll be events, dear boy, events that'll change as well. And so we'll be back here for more events in Melbourne for you to come along to, hopefully, and showcase some more research that the Lowy Institute's done. Thanks very much, and if you could join with me in thanking the panel.